Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to What's the Crack interview episode. I'm going to be talking today with Dr. Gail Gilchrist, and we're going to be talking about perpetrators and perpetration of intimate partner violence to link up with the podcast we did a couple of months ago with Karen Bailey. So I'm here with Dr. Gail Gilchrist. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yep. Hi. Thanks for asking me. So I am a senior lecturer in the Addictions Department at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience. And my research has focused for about the past 20 years on, more taking a gendered approach to looking at substance use and mental health and childhood abuse, domestic violence and so on, and more laterally thinking about how we could possibly develop interventions to address some of these issues.
Okay. And that work that you do, just to kind of introduce the area that we're going to, you've done quite a lot of work with victims and perpetrators intimate partner violence. And how has that work differed, or how has that kind of grown?
Well, I mean, I think there's unfortunately some common risk factors for both victimisation and perpetration. And when we're looking at substance users, not all substance users, obviously, but when we're talking about people who've experienced violence or perpetrate violence, there's quite often a sort of high comorbidity, high multiple disadvantage. So some of that contextual stuff obviously feeds into to people's lifestyles and lives and the experience that they have or perpetrate. So, yeah, so my PhD many years ago was looking at psychiatric comorbidity among women who use drugs, and that's when there's a very high prevalence of childhood abuse and domestic violence and also violence during working and sex trading and so on was highlighted. And then you also look at, well, at least 50% or higher of women in drug treatment and alcohol treatment have partners who are also substance users. So it sort of followed on from that they must also be the people who were perpetrating violence. So we started looking at that. And that was probably now, a good 8 years ago or something was the first study we started.
And so is that something, you've been working in this area for, say, 20 years or so. Is that, how has the focus on perpetration changed in that time? Was it something that was looked at?
Well, I think it has, because I think sort of historically the focus, and rightly so, was on victims or survivors and how they could be assisted. And I guess the sort of treatment approaches for men was generally through criminal justice, and we know that they, at the moment, I think it's about 10, well, criminal justice and community services, and criminal justice, I think in our study, something like 15% of men had ever been arrested for perpetration of violence, so there's a huge amount of unmet need there. Okay. And at the moment, we know community services for community perpetrator services, so where men either volunteer or are referred, I think they only meet about 10% of demand. So it's a huge amount of unmet need. So we're looking at seeing whether delivering sort of interventions that look at substance use and perpetration would be better delivered in substance use treatment services if possible.
Okay. A lot of the associations, I guess, between addiction, between substance use, between intimate partner violence and perpetration, and particularly thinking about perpetration, what I mean, is there, and why is there such a link between intimate partner violence and substance misuse?
Obviously not all men who abuse or use substances or who are in treatment for yeah. Substance use perpetrate violence towards their partner. But we know that about 4 in 10 men in substance use treatment have been physically or sexually violent towards their partner in the last year of their relationship, and that increases to about 7 in 10 men when we talk about psychological abuse. Obviously, you know, I've heard Karen's podcast, and she rightly so criticises the assessments that are used in these kinds of studies, which might talk about events rather than yeah. a sort of pattern of behaviour.
How does that 4 in 10 and 7 in 10, how does that relate to like the general population?
Well, again, there's not that great estimates of yeah. perpetration. There's more better estimates of victimisation. But from the studies that we have looked at, it would suggest it's about... they're all higher, but there's some studies would suggest they're about 4 times higher in substance using men in treatment than men in the general population. But it's also higher among men in the general population in those kind of population studies or other clinical studies where men have... issues with drugs or alcohol.
Okay.
And similarly, if you look at populations that are arrested or in treatment for domestic violence perpetration, they also have higher rates of substance use. So there's okay. definitely something going on there. I would clearly state that there's no one single factor or one single reason that explains why some men are more likely to be violent than others. You know, okay. there's lots of factors have been reported, including substance use, so things like lower socioeconomic status, abuse in childhood, witnessing violence between your parents in childhood,
okay.
Mental health problems, higher anger expression, you know, other general forms of violence, sort of support of gender-specific roles, and also a sort of acceptance that violence against women is okay. They all contribute to, to intimate partner violence. But alcohol and I'd say cocaine and sort of methamphetamine type drugs have consistently been shown to be a risk factor for engaging in violence. And a recent review that's just come out has concluded that, you know, alcohol use is as strong a predictor than, you know, some of the other factors that have been more traditionally put forward, such as support for gender-specific roles or anger or poor marital functioning. But, I mean, I can go on to talk a little bit about, why alcohol and drugs might be, you know, a specific or a more specific role, if that would be of help.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first part of what you were saying there is there a suggestion, Pat, that some of the things that lead people to say addiction, some of those, you know, things like socioeconomic status and childhood abuse, and, you know, kind of having a pretty bad life, some of those things increase people's risk for substance misuse as well as increasing their risk for intimate partner violence.
It's very complex, the interplay between all of those, multiple disadvantage and lifestyle.
Yeah, and then on top of that, to kind of compound that, there's then very strong associations with substance misuse, particularly you were saying with alcohol, and it's interesting, isn't it, that you have those substances, you have alcohol, you have cocaine and methamphetamine, I think you mentioned,
but I think the reason that they're coming out as strong predictors is when people are looking or people think of the role of substances specifically around the role of intoxication, and that those kinds of drugs may facilitate a specific response. But I think there's a lot more potential explanations than that, and also there's different kinds of perpetrators. So, you know, very basically, there's people, or in this case we're talking about men, who perpetrate severe and escalating forms of violence. So that's the sort of terrorisation and threats, controlling behaviour, as well as multiple forms of abuse. And then there's others who may perpetrate a more moderate form of relationship violence, you know, so arguments and frustration and anger can lead to arguments and so on.
Okay.
And we've been trying to look at whether, you know, whether these typologies do fit with alcohol and drug use, and I think they don't necessarily. I think there's, you know, different things for different people at different times and all the rest of it.
So it's more complicated than
I think it's extraordinarily complicated, unfortunately, as most of these things are.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think we know things like alcohol or physical harm is more likely and more severe on days where people have been heavy drinking.
Okay.
But again, it's what is the nature of that contribution. So there's, you know, there's in our culture, there's a very strong expectation that, you know, alcohol facilitates violence. Mm. And so substance users might or people might blame the substance. But certainly, you know, there's the argument that it's the pharmacological properties of the substance that lead to impaired cognitive functioning or cognitive processing, sorry, that could result in violence.
Or inhibition. Is that
or inhibition. Yeah, so exactly as I said, you know, the substance use might cause arguments that lead to violence and so on, or that they're completely unrelated, but they have a shared risk factor.
Okay.
You know, sort of what you were talking about earlier. And then there's another sort of argument for, well, people who are not generally violent, that alcohol or drugs might be that mechanism for reducing, you know, I guess their perceived threat or threshold when they might be violent. But the work that we've been doing, so my colleague Faye has been looking at lots of qualitative studies around both perpetrator and victim accounts of how substance use might feature. And it's not just about, you know, it's quite a complex, I guess, intersection. So it's not just about thinking about intoxication. It's around,
okay.
You know, so that's when, you know, why it's still high among people with who are using drugs like heroin and other drugs.
Yeah.
It's the sort of whole lifestyle. So it's when you're in withdrawal. It's when you've got no money for drugs.
Yeah.
It's when you're arguing over drugs and other things. Whole
crime,
array
crime
of things.
And
but I also think what we found, so myself and Polly Radcliffe, or Polly led this qualitative research, again looking at, you know, men who had perpetrated, or women in substance use treatment who had perpetrated violence, mm. and their sort of explanations of how substance use featured in that. And it was quite similar to what I've just talked about, but also within all of the accounts, the sort of dominance and acceptance of male and female roles, and
okay.
you know, they sort of provide a context for, you know, almost making intimate partner violence explicable and acceptable.
Interesting.
So,
and does that change internationally in societies where those kind of gendered expectations are different? Do you know?
Well, I mean, the research would suggest in societies where, you know, there is more gender inequality or more support for violence towards women as being acceptable or gender inequitable roles, that they've had higher intimate partner violence prevalences. Which so we did a study comparing men in substance use treatment in London in the southeast of England with
okay.
men in treatment in Sao Paulo in Brazil.
Okay.
And we looked at emotional, physical, sexual, intimate partner violence. We also looked at controlling behaviour and what we've called technology-facilitated abuse. So, like, checking people's GPS, checking them,
wow.
So checking people's phones, setting up tracking devices in people's phones, checking their messages, Facebook pages, those kinds of things.
That's really interesting. It's so obvious now you say it, but I hadn't thought of the role of technology in abuse. That's
yeah,
really
it's certainly as technology progresses, it sort of makes these kinds of things a lot easier.
Yeah.
And I guess lots of people don't think of that.
Yeah.
We did find differences between the prevalence and also the risk factors in both treatment settings. So, for example, in England, there was no difference in emotional intimate partner violence. I think that was about 63% in both
okay.
sites.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
But then when we looked at physical violence, men in England were more likely to have perpetrated physical violence. That was 60% versus 51%.
Okay.
But then when we look in at sexual violence, men in Brazil were more likely to perpetrate sexual violence than men in England. Okay. So 16% versus 6%. So we started to, I'll go on to talk about the risk factors as well, but we started to think, why might that be? Because we would have expected differences between the countries based on what I just said. So we think it's more to do probably with the makeup of the client group that we had in each country, because we know that in England the men in treatment had more support for gender equitable relations and attitudes, better attitudes towards gender roles than the men in Brazil did.
Okay.
But we sort of think that the explanation for the higher physical violence, as I said, is to do with the differences between the two client groups. So in England, we had a much higher prevalence of homelessness, unemployment, people receiving benefits, higher childhood violence, higher injecting, more polydrug use, higher physical criminality, okay. Weapons, all sorts of things that we didn't see in the cohort in Brazil. But then when we think of why Brazil might be more likely to have a higher prevalence of sexual violence, well, they had a higher proportion of men who'd been unfaithful to their wife or their partners.
Okay.
In some of the questions that we asked, they were more likely to agree or strongly agree with statements like, if a woman doesn't physically fight back, it's not rape, or that a woman can't refuse to have sex with her husband.
Okay.
And so some of those things might explain, we don't have a full-on explanation,
yeah.
But these are the sorts of things we're thinking might... might account for some of the differences.
From what I can gather there, so there's some cultural differences in the makeup of people attending drug treatment services.
Yeah.
So in the UK they tend to be
more polydrug user. I mean, they were more in treatment for drug use and polydrug use than they were in I think it was a higher proportion in treatment for alcohol in Brazil.
Oh, interesting.
And obviously cocaine.
And was there any difference in the amount of people who were referred through criminal justice settings, or are they kind of similar?
It's similar setup, because we did spend a bit of time in seeing around the services and things like that. It's all voluntary. There's a lot of commonalities in the risk factors, but things like anger or higher anger expression and a greater number of childhood adversities were definitely associated with different kinds of violence in both settings.
Okay. In a sense, while you were doing that research, you were able to pick apart some universal indicators for intimate partner violence, as well as some individual and differences between those countries.
We did. We looked at all of those predictors that I talked about at the start that are known from the literature. We looked at all of those, and then the ones that were significant in each country, we sort of modelled to try and find out which were the strongest predictors. And we found out that a higher anger expression, higher depressive symptoms, greater number of childhood experiences were associated with perpetrating any kind of violence towards your partner in both countries, but physical fighting with another man in the past year was significant in Brazil only, and more hazardous drinking or higher score in the hazardous drinking assessment in England was also associated, but not in Brazil, with perpetrating.
Okay.
And this is any emotional, physical or sexual violence. And then we also tried to... we had to put both samples together for this, but we tried to see if there was any difference between the types of violence. So was there any difference between the men who perpetrated emotional, physical or sexual violence?
Okay.
And I think, compared to people who were never perpetrating any violence, anger or being more likely to be anger, having a higher anger expression, was associated with emotional and physical violence. Fighting physically with another man was associated with physical IPV perpetration, and the having a higher number of childhood adversities and being more likely to be a hazardous drinker were associated with both physical and sexual intimate partner violence. Okay. So I think that, you know, not that that I'm excusing anyone's behaviour, but there's things to think about there with how we deal as a society with childhood violence and also with mental health problems among or resulting from childhood violence or among people with substance use problems.
So when you're doing research here with perpetrators of intimate partner violence, and I guess as you've said already, this is often typified by a pattern of behaviour that continues. And I guess that, in a sense, mirrors substance misuse, which is, you know, a pattern of behaviour that continues, which people want to change. What's the research on how people in that pattern of behaviour of perpetrating intimate partner violence, how they are able to change or willing to change? Or
well, I guess that's different for different people. And there's a lot of studies, whether it's addiction or mental health, or not mental health, sorry, intimate partner violence, about motivation for change and making sure people are ready. But if you look at the reasons why some people come into treatment, it's often about a relationship breakdown or, you know, the threat of losing contact with children and okay. things like that. So that, I guess, it can be seen as a window of opportunity. So I think that, you know, what we're looking at the moment about the interventions that are out there, there's some really good examples of good practice going on in London, where drug treatment services are working together with perpetrator services, and they're developing integrated interventions to look at both problems simultaneously. At the moment, we've been looking at doing a systematic review of what works. And it's difficult because if you're doing a systematic review, you're only looking at, you know, really rigorous evidence of trials. Lots of those are small trials. They have shown, sort of CBT with motivational interviewing, integrating substance use and perpetration type interventions show some promising evidence. But there's been reductions in the control groups as well. You know, and again, that's what I was saying. Depending on, it doesn't mean that they don't work. You know, any change is better than no change. And I guess depending on the type of perpetrator and the severity of perpetration, maybe people need different sort of inputs. But thinking about, you know, when we were going back to, you know, what's the role of substance use, there are some studies that show when you reduce someone's substance use, you reduce the violence. But I guess they might be the people who are having the arguments around the substance use rather than the controlling, you know, threatening. That. So it's quite, as we pointed out, it's quite complicated. But I mean, there's some modelling, population study modelling, that shows if you could take away all of the negative consequences from substance use disorders, it's only going to reduce domestic violence perpetration by 14%.
Okay.
So I think that's what I want to get across. It's not just the substance use.
It's part of the story.
It's part of the, and addressing that as part of the solution.
So those things that you mentioned, like CBT and motivational interviewing, they're kind of talking therapies, like kind of psychosocial interventions, talking therapies, where someone might sit down with a key worker and
talk. They're mostly delivered in groups at the moment, or some are individuals. So, I mean, I'm just basing this on the interventions that we've been looking at. What I would like to say at the moment in that men with substance use problems are not often referred to perpetrator services.
Okay.
And when they are, they're more likely to drop out or not even turn up. So that was one of the rationales for starting to think about how we could deliver, or we, the Royal We, how services could be delivered in substance use treatment settings where people already have trust and are... and are working there. We've done some work with substance use settings and domestic violence settings, and you know, everyone is well aware of the relationship between the two, but they don't have protocols or, you know, clear referral pathways or guidance of what to do with that. And even looking at the NICE guidance, substance use isn't really a feature of that, or treatment for people with substance use, although they, you know, they highlight there's a need there.
And I guess especially when you know, it sounds like there's also a need to link in with mental health services quite regularly with that, and I'm guessing that has a similar difficulty or challenge. What's happening next? What does the future of intimate partner violence research look like?
Well, for us, we've recently been awarded a 5-year programme grant from the NIHR, which we've called Advancing Theory and Treatment Approaches for Men in Substance Use Treatment who Perpetrate Intimate Partner Violence. And we are looking at developing evidence to, or we are developing evidence to develop and test an integrated intervention. So that's something looking at substance use and intimate partner violence perpetration to be delivered in a substance use treatment setting to reduce violence among men, but also support their partners and ex-partners to increase, I guess, their safety and well-being. We've done separate interviews in the past with women who've experienced violence or men who have perpetrated violence from drug treatment services, but this time we're recruiting men, and then so men who screen positive for domestic violence, and then we're also trying to interview their partners. So for the first time we're looking at dyad interviews to see, I guess, to get a better a better understanding of what's happening in the relationship.
Dyad interview.
Yeah, so the both partners.
Okay.
Dyad two people. And sometimes more than two people. Yes, because we're looking at partners and ex-partners as well. If we're able to get in touch with them. So if people were interested in hearing more about the Advanced Programme Grant and our findings as they come about, they could follow our blog or subscribe to our blog, which I'm going to plug shamelessly, which is blogs.kcl.ac.uk/advance/.
We'll put a link on the
even better
podcast as well.
And as well as our own research on there, we are also happy to publicise events and reports and papers, newspaper articles, debates, anything that people are interested in posting, we'd be happy to put up and contribute to the discussion and, I guess, the advancing of treatment approaches for this population.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's fascinating work, such an important area as well. So
thank you.
Really do get in touch. Is there anything that you want to add?
No.
Okay, well, thanks ever so much for your time, Gail. Hopefully we'll be back soon with some more interviews.
Excellent.
So,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.